Welcome to this weekend's episode of Nevada Backcountry, only on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Thank you to Shooting Performance Institute for sponsoring the show. And fair warning to all of you listening, as we've talked about on the show, I've got an archery cow tag starting, so we are pre-recording this and we'll probably do at some point a rerun episode. If there's anything in particular that listeners want to hear, by all means, send us a text, 884-9910. You can go to the website, click on the Contact Us tab. Send us some ideas if there is something that you guys want to hear. Otherwise, I'll just kind of look at like what's relevant to what's going on right now. Ideally, I won't have to find one because I'll be back. That kind of sucks. It hurts me in my heart to say, but ideally I'll get it done pretty darn quick and I'm back in the office going about my business, getting ready for your bull hunt, Dave.
Yeah.
So that's the lay of the land right now. Like I said, if you got ideas, something you want to hear, or you go, hey, remember last year you guys talked about this, I can dig up those episodes out of the archives and I'll re-air that. Without further ado, let's jump into a trending news story right now, Dave.
I think that's a good idea.
This grizzly reintroduction.
Yes.
In California.
In Northern California.
So those that don't know, it's an organization called, I'm trying to stifle my laughter, Rewilding Earth, that is proposing this. That's the name of the organization. They would like to reintroduce 1,000 grizzlies into California.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. As if...
Just the name alone just gives me just this bizarre
Rewilding
image
Earth.
Yeah. Of some guy dancing through the forest in a skirt, waving...
Hell yeah.
Yeah, waving like incense. You know what I mean?
Well, see, yeah. You went the opposite direction I did, because when I hear these things like Rewilding Earth, I know it's some idiot sitting in a coffee shop that they drove to in their Tesla in downtown Los Angeles going, wouldn't this be a fantastic name to accomplish our goals under?
Oh, God,
and I'm
yes.
Like, I just can't stand those people. So yeah. Rewilding Earth.
Rewilding Earth. And I bet you he has a man bun.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
I was going to say something about Birkenstocks.
We're such dicks.
Well, I was going to say something about the Birkenstocks, but I like Birkenstocks.
I gotta say, I've got a pair.
Yeah.
Or two. They are very comfortable.
I won't go there with it, but yeah, they want to reintroduce grizzly. 1,000.
1,000.
How'd they come up with that number?
Oh, I guarantee you it wasn't scientific.
No, and Dave has all the, this is your bailiwick, so I'm going to yield my time to you in just a second. A couple quick things. Male grizzly bears, they use 200 to 600 square miles. That's their territory. Part of the population they want to put in places like Yosemite Valley.
Oh, God.
Hey, look, that is within a 600 square mile radius of Nevada. I just think this is such a stupid idea. Females up to 300 square mile territory, little less on females, but still, if you think you're going to put these bears somewhere and they're going to stay there, like set up shop and just stay there, you're nuts. Higher than Hunter Biden.
Yeah.
It ain't going to happen.
It ain't going to happen.
So now, Dave, drop some facts on me about reintroducing apex predators or just reintroductions in general.
Well, specifically grizzly bears. I mean, it was done in the North Cascades in Washington many years ago, and their plan was to introduce roughly 25 over many years.
Right.
About 7 a year. So you're talking like maybe 4 years or so. And it didn't work out too well. It's been kind of halted due to several environmental issues as well as government holdbacks. But the issue that's going on with a lot of the predator style reintroductions, gray wolves, Mexican gray wolves, and is you're taking an animal that is technically it's captive bred.
Right.
So they're being bred in a sense where they've got a limited ability or knowledge for their natural predation,
right,
how they get their food. And that's going to take many generations before they get that true wild back.
If they make it many generations.
If they make it many. Yeah. Some of these populations are having issues now with bottlenecking, genetic bottlenecking, which is going to really cause a major issue further down the line. I mean, probably wipe them out, possibly. The other is you got the ranching component. So these apex predators like grizzlies and some of these wolves, they're going to target the easiest thing on the market, is a cow,
yep,
or a calf, or a sheep, or a goat, or your chickens, you know, that type of a thing. So these ranchers are having significant conflicts with these animals. Therefore, you know, they can...
It becomes a
nuisance animal. So some of the reintroductions, populations 10, 15 years later, are still not quite at the stable point, because once they start habituating to taking out cattle, taking out livestock, that's what they kind of teach the young.
Okay.
So it removes them from truly being the wild component.
Right.
Like going after the deer and the elk and other things. I know some of the reintroductions were based on to help control the populations of the elk herds and didn't really work out, you know,
no,
in most cases, because they do.
Why are you going to try to take down an elk when there's like a 1,200 pound cow standing in a pasture that,
right, or a calf,
or a calf
just sitting there, or sheep or goats, or, you know, whatever else they might be ranching.
Yeah.
There's a lot of studies going on in relation to, like, how are these reintroductions true? When you're talking with apex predators, how effective are they? Because you're pulling them from a captive bred community and then just saying, shooting them out of the box and saying, all right, go do it. It's a difficult process, man.
I would point out the differences in black bear and grizzly bear behavior.
Oh, God.
I would be willing to bet that nobody from Rewilding Earth has actually encountered a wild grizzly bear. You know, maybe they've done the scenic cruise or whatever in Alaska, but that was the first thing I noticed when my brother and I had that standoff with the grizzly bear is, you know, we're out there to try to kill a black bear, and they're like, might as well be deer or something. You know, they wind you or whatever, and they're gone.
Yeah.
They're like, no, I'm out of here. Something smells funky, whatever. I'm gone. The grizzly bear we had an encounter with, it just stood there, had zero fear, in the fight or flight response, it was 100% like, no, I'm going to stand my ground and fight. I don't know what those guys are. Like, what's that thing over there waving its arms yelling at me? But I don't care. So when you introduce something or reintroduce something like a grizzly bear, we're not talking about something that's going to go, oh, headlights, I'm spooked, I'm out of here. Apex predator, that thing's gonna stand there. It has no fear of people.
No.
It has no fear of whatever your domestic livestock. It's a different thing. I think people get those, they see the bears around Tahoe and they're like, oh, look at that cute,
like, or the ones around like Sequoia National Park,
yeah,
where they're tattooed, ears are pierced, collars on, numbers painted on the side of them, and the poor things just look like just been beat to, you know, just beat down.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, look how cute that is. Yeah.
Grizzlies are different,
man. It's a different deal.
Yeah.
And especially when you're dealing with an apex predator like that there's nothing that preys on them.
Nope.
Besides us.
Yeah. Well, and other grizzlies when they're cubs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So there isn't anything for them to truly fear. You know, they smell something funky. They're like, wonder what that is. Let me check it out. And then they stand up and they're 7'5" and you're like, wow.
And we'll go from 0 to 35 in the blink of an eye.
And they can run incredibly fast. You'll see videos of those things like chasing down full-grown cow elk.
Yes.
Just catching them like Carl Lewis style. It's just like,
a good
dude,
reference.
That thing is nuts.
Yeah.
Thing is so fast.
Yes.
And the thing is with those, same with black bears, grizzlies, if they want you, there's nothing you can do. I mean, they can climb a 100-foot tree in about 10 seconds. They can run way faster than you. And that's why they're an apex predator. That's why they're the king.
Have you seen any of the proposed? The one that came up was Yosemite Valley.
Right,
they were
Yosemite.
Talking about. It's mostly the Sierra, right? Is where they want to reintroduce them.
Pretty much, but 1,000. I mean, I don't know where in the world they came up with that. There's such a territorial animal. That'd be nuts. 1,000.
Yeah.
1,000.
I think about North Idaho, where it was like, oh, there's an estimated 50 grizzlies in the Selkirk Range or whatever. And those things are showing up in like McCall.
Yeah.
You know,
could,
like,
you imagine 1,000?
No.
Yeah, we're just going to dump.
With an estimated 50, they're pushing each other all over the males.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking, again, a 600 square mile range. They're going to wind up where you don't want them to wind up.
Well, yeah, and the next issue would be as they're pushing each other out and the dominant one's taking control of their area, the one that didn't make it is now getting pushed into another bear's area. And so eventually you're going to end up with a few bears that are going to be starving. They're yes. going to be very aggressive. And they see Betty Boop walking the hiking trail, you know, in her
low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. And then they're like, oh my gosh, I wonder why that thing did that. There's reasons.
Yes.
There's reasons.
When we come back on the show, we've talked a lot about like the human bear interaction. I also want to bring up the wildlife component, and we'll dive a little bit deeper into the subject. Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. And we are back on Nevada Backcountry, only on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Thank you to Battleborn Tree Service for sponsoring the show, for hunters, by hunters. Let's jump right back into the grizzly bear reintroduction. That first segment, Dave, we covered a lot of like, okay, livestock interactions, human interactions. Here's what I wanted to bring up in regard to the effect on other wildlife in California. And I've said it a dozen times on the show, I still hang the mountain lion thing around Ronald Reagan's neck. He signed the No Hunting of Mountain Lions bill in 1971. Since 1971, people have not been able to manage the mountain lion population in the state of California. So you already have one apex predator on the landscape that goes unchecked and unmanaged. Now you're talking about adding a second into that equation because, again, you're not going to be able to hunt them.
No.
You're just going to cast this thing out there or a thousand things out there and hope it works out for the best. You know, we've talked on the show before the over-the-counter turkey tags. There's over-the-counter deer tags. Man, all that disappears if you're talking about throwing another apex predator into the mix. And that's what I don't get when these organizations call themselves stuff like Rewilding Earth. For the non-claw and fang species on the landscape, it's already plenty wild enough, right?
Yeah.
So what in the world are you talking about with this?
And environmentally or other species wise, there's a lot of things that need to be looked at. Like, when was the last time a grizzly bear was even in the California area?
I think it was 1928.
Yeah.
I think that was when the last grizzly was killed in California.
Just over 100 years ago was the last one. Prior to that, I mean, holy Lord. So you've got this system that has rebalanced itself without the grizzlies around.
Oh, yeah.
So that's rebalanced themselves. So you start introducing another, especially an apex predator, to a system. So
and I'm going to correct myself real quick. 1922, I just looked it up. I was close with 28.
You were close. That's why I said it was just over 100 years ago. It was the last known grizzly in the area.
And ironically enough, it was in Tulare County. So like the Central Valley. Of all the places would think that, a grizzly bear. The last grizzly bear, 1922 in Tulare County, Central Valley.
And that's the place where they're going to put the first one.
Yeah, perfect.
No. So, but for the entire system itself, introducing something like that, there's several factors you got to worry about. You got to worry about disease because they were captive bred. What if they bring a disease that has not been expressed in that particular region? And you know, some of the main ones are respiratory issues.
Right.
Animals can carry those things and not have any effect.
Right.
Until domestic sheep, when they get into wild sheep, you know, the bighorn sheep, they carry that pneumonia thing all over the place. They don't express it until it doesn't get expressed until they get into a wild population, mingling with a wild population.
So they could carry something that like would kill a bobcat, but it doesn't affect a grizzly bear.
Coyote, it could kill the elk. I mean, you don't know. You don't know what the zoonotic effects might be.
Right.
On other populations.
And then you've got an explosion of field mice and everything else. Then you've got problems from that. And what is that? Like a cascade effect, basically.
Exactly. So You know, so then it creates this imbalance with other predators that are in the area. You've got your coyotes, you've got your bobcats, you've got your wolves, you've got your martens, your mountain lions. How long is it going to take to rebalance that out? I mean, that's not known. How does it affect all these other species as well, especially when you're talking such a large apex predator?
That covers ground.
That covers significant amount of ground. So there's a lot of environmental factors that really come to play because they're not like affecting any type of habitat. They're not improving any habitat for these animals to come in like they've done with the other species.
Right.
They're just kind of like, they used to live here. Let's drop them off. You know,
and the landscape is dramatically different.
In 100 years, that California landscape,
yeah,
that has changed a great deal. So,
do you know by any chance where these bears are coming from, where they're proposing?
I'd assume probably Canada or something in that somewhere along there.
Okay.
I would assume because that's some of the highest densities of grizzlies. I know the ones from Washington that were introduced into Washington, they came from Canada.
Okay. I was going to say that, in fact, right where my dad and I were on that moose hunt last year was the grizzly attack capital, Sundry, Alberta.
Yeah.
They're just, well, I told you that, I think it was the first night we were walking out and it was just like, it might as well have been a game trail down this logging road of grizzly tracks.
Jeez.
And it was like, whoa, there's a lot of these. And even the guide who grew up there and, you know, even he stopped for a second and he goes, hey, fellas, we should probably put some headlamps on and make a little noise. So we started talking a little louder. But yeah, I mean, right there, Sundry, Alberta is like the grizzly attack capital. Canada would make sense.
Yeah,
a pile
that's where I would assume that they'd pull them from. But I, realistically, I mean, their proposal is way out to lunch.
Oh, it is?
Out to lunch.
Well, I mean, just on the surface, from my uneducated, I'm like, 1,000 bears? Good God.
And want to reintroduce them to their some of their historical locations. You look at some of their historical locations on a map.
Downtown Sacramento?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the same habitat it was 150, 200 years ago. I mean, we're not going to just go to the 1922 when the last one was harvested or killed.
Yeah.
You're going to go further back.
Yeah.
To when they were an established population. So you're talking going back 200 years. Has California changed? I don't care. Northern California. We know Southern has, but Northern in the last 200 years? Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you need to, one of the things that they don't even mention is the potential impacts of these animals on this new landscape that is completely different than the landscape that they had 200 years ago.
Yeah, they used to probably be able to roam 600 square miles and not run into a human being.
You're not going 50 miles in California without probably running into a road, a trail, a visitor center, you know, a Starbucks, something. Yeah.
That Tulare County thing cracks me up
because
that's
hilarious.
Citrus and that's like ag.
That's all agricultural now. I mean, 200 years ago, it was probably absolutely gorgeous with trees and everything else, but now, all the water sources have been buttoned up for agricultural.
Oh, God, yes.
I mean, come on.
Okay.
So, anyway.
Well, there you go. So, complete lunacy. I'm looking at the clock here. Let's wrap up this segment on the reintroduction thing. What else you got, Dave?
Well, just some of the reintroductions over the years for the gray wolf and the Mexican gray wolf. There's been some studies on tracking some of the collared ones and some of the how they're doing. So you got the Arizona and New Mexico Mexican gray wolf that was introduced. How long ago was that? 30 years ago almost now?
98.
Okay. So you're getting there. You keep flip-flopping. Keep flip-flopping that.
22, 28. Yeah.
And as of today, or as of the end of 2024, there are roughly 257 of these gray wolves now roaming around. 145 in New Mexico and 112 or so in Arizona.
Okay.
And they're getting pretty close to the recovery goal of what was ever, 300, I think it was. But they're not quite at a stable state yet.
What's the exit strategy, I'll call it? So let's say the population hits, what'd you say, 250 some odd?
Yeah, right now almost 260 is what it's at, but they want 300.
They want 300. Okay. So when it gets to 300, and this is the behind the scenes stuff that I'll ask you because, you know, everyday common man, I don't hear what the exit strategy on this stuff is. So when they get to 300, what then?
That's a good question because I have not seen anything in the reporting that talks about,
hey, we're going to have a season now.
Right,
or
exactly.
We're going to whatever. Like,
yeah, exactly. What happens once they hit that 300 mark? Do they just all high-five each other and say, we did it? And then what?
You give the wolves a stern talking to and make sure they know they can't breed anymore? What?
I don't know. So something, there would have to be some form of a management program set aside.
Okay.
It's kind of like the wolves in Colorado. They've released 10 wolves into that area in like 2023.
Yeah.
With plans to release roughly up to 50, over the next few years. And same thing there. They want a viable population of roughly 300 over the next 20-year period. See them expand to that size. So same thing, like you said, once they are at that so-called threshold number.
Population, yeah.
What then?
I got to assume that at least the conversation's been had. If I'm sitting here going, well, what then? I got to assume somebody who does this day in and day out, this is their whole livelihood is wildlife management. I got to assume the question's been asked, but it's certainly not shared with the general public as far as, hey, once we get to this, then we go into phase, whatever the deal.
Yeah, whatever it is right now. They're still vulnerable, and their vulnerability is coming from the genetic bottlenecking of these populations. Too much of that. And eventually the population will just wean itself out. It's kind of like that family in West Virginia, the most inbred family in West Virginia. It'll turn into one of those scenarios. Yeah. And then the other big one is their conflicts with livestock and ranchers. In my opinion, the ranchers have every right to protect their resource. This is their meat and potatoes. This feeds their families, pays the mortgage, and all that kind of stuff. So if you got a pack of wolves in there that are whacking your cattle and your calves left and right, I completely agree that they should be
able
to
do what you got to do.
You take them out. So there's that massive conflict. And that conflict secondarily leads to them teaching their offspring, this is how we feed. This is how we hunt.
Right.
If the population continues to focus on the livestock component of their food source, that's going to end up being a major issue.
On that note, we got some more lighthearted topics coming up. Don't touch that dial. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Welcome back to Nevada Backcountry. If you miss a segment of the show, you can always go to the website 991fmtalk.com. Click on the podcast tab. Everything is there. For Apple users, go to Apple Podcasts and search for Nevada Backcountry. Total 180 degree shift. We're going to go archery real quick. So I just got back from the Battle Mountain Best of the West shoot, and man, what a phenomenal course. The layout was great from a hunting perspective. They had a bunch of those like tight to the sage, or they do a great job. Oh man, Andrew and the crew out there, kudos. They had one, it was a great shot. It was an antelope at 70 yards, and you could see like in the V of the sage, you could see the neck of it. You could sidestep away from the stake and see the full target. And then you had to step back to the stake and shoot, and you had to trust that your arrow was going to arc over these clumps of sage into the target. So it was really cool because it was like, okay, I know the vitals are clear. I've got to make a shot now where my pin is sitting on this sage branch, 60 yards downrange, my arrow is going to be arcing in. So, I mean, it just shots like that. It was great shooting along Willow Creek Reservoir, Willow Creek Ponds, beautiful little oasis out there. And present company excluded, the Evans family represented extremely well. My daughter, Alice, got first place. My daughter Madeline got second place. And the big winner, my wife Cynthia, brought home $200 cash for winning the women's division.
Boom.
It was awesome, man.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it was a great shoot. We had a blast. I was flighted with DJ Wilson.
Oh, yeah. He's awesome to shoot with, man. Him and Tina.
So I got flighted with he and Andrew, the president. So that was my group on the second day. And
she smells better.
Oh, I bet. He makes that joke too, Dave.
Yeah, he does too.
Yeah. I said, hey, where's Tina? And he said something about why you want her here. And I was like, oh, no, I was just wondering where she is. He's like, she smells better anyway.
Smart man.
Yeah, he's good. Yeah. After that shoot, now I'm like, only thing leaving my bow are broadheads.
Yeah, I didn't get to make that shoot because I was out staring scouting. At elk. Scouting for elk.
Now, continuing on the archery subject, the thing everybody's been talking about, there's been this huge study going on, and you and I were talking over the break. James Yates is the guy that did it, along with Easton Arrows, and then I think Precision Cut Archery,
yeah.
They were involved. This is the most comprehensive test I've ever seen done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they tested different arrow types, diameters.
Yep.
They used different vanes. They used
fixed blade broadheads. Mechanicals.
Hybrid. The new hybrid series coming out. Because there are just, if you've had a chance to look at it, there are literally hundreds of different broadheads on the market now.
Yep.
Myself, I've been shooting the Slick Trick Magnums and the Standards for probably the last 12 years.
Been around forever.
They have killed everything I've put an arrow through.
Yep.
And they've been fantastic. With all this new study stuff going on, I'm now like, man, maybe I should look into, you know, some of these other broadheads.
Well,
so,
hey, Dave.
This study came out.
We'll jump right to that section.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that itch, you can go ahead and get rid of it. Because what was the second most accurate broadhead in the test? Slick Trick Standards.
For the
fixed blades.
Yes.
Yep.
I'm very happy.
Yeah. It's not, that's the thing. Like, people ask me, hey, what? In fact, I just picked up my data pack because he was going, what are you shooting? What's the latest, greatest, this, that, and the other thing? And this was before I even saw the study. And I said, Dad, hey, look, I'll run over to Hunting House and I'll just grab you a pack of Slick Trick Standards. That's what I like.
Yeah.
I've got a box of broadheads because there's always something. Anglers, golfers, archers.
Man. Everything.
There's always like a new little tweak that you're like, ooh, maybe that would make me shoot a little better.
Yeah. I've got three different types of broadheads. I've got two types that I haven't used in years because of my Slick Tricks.
Right.
And I've got a dozen of each of them. One, they haven't made, well, they don't make either one of them anymore. One of them, if anyone remembers, is called the Crossfire. So that's where...
doesn't even ring a bell.
Exactly. That is where the three blades, it's a three-blade fixed broadhead, but the three blades spin.
Oh, you showed those to me.
Yeah.
That's a way cool broadhead.
It is phenomenal. That thing shoots like a dart because it moves.
Yeah.
It is friggin' off, but I don't shoot them now because I'm like, dude, they don't make them anymore.
I got three.
Can't get the replacement ferrule head, so...
Oh.
So they're like, now they just sit on the wall like an... like a museum piece, but
yeah.
So people know the difference between, which I think is kind of funny, is they have the Slick Trick Standard and then the Slick Trick Magnums. There's literally, I mean, the only difference is the Slick Trick Standard is a 1-inch cutting diameter. The Slick Trick Magnums is a 1 1/8. That is it. Yeah. Other than that, the broadheads are totally identical.
Are they? Okay. I thought the Magnum had a slightly longer ferrule.
I've got both of them,
and they're the same.
I put them up against each other, and you really can't tell the difference between the two. The Magnum, the blade, the inside, you know, when you put them together and slide them together, is just a hair different cut because it's just a hair wider. That's it. So, and I'm shooting the Magnums right now, and they shoot great.
I've been shooting those Standards, but I'll tell for listeners. And these, I'll give a few parameters to the test here. So James Yates, for those that don't know, kills monster mule deer on public land with a bow every single year. And he is a professional engineer by day.
He geeks out on all the stats.
You couldn't pick a better guy to do a study like this. You know, it's not one of these guys that's like, yeah, I drew a tag. I didn't really get to shoot in anything, but man, this broadhead's the best. And it's like, well, what's that based on?
Yeah,
you didn't. Right. I thought you didn't shoot at anything. Like, what? Okay. James Yates kills giant stuff every single year. If he says, hey, this is what works, like, he knows what he's talking about. But he's also got that analytical side where it's like, well, I think this is the best because I've killed X number of animals with it. But let's shoot it next to a decibel meter. Let's blah, blah, blah. That was the parameters of the test. Everything was shot at 70 yards out of a Hooter shooter, which for those that don't know is like an automated machine that draws the bow and fires. So there's no like human interface. So right. It's as perfect as you can get coming out of a bow. The three best mechanicals, let's see, it was the Schwacker 261, Sever 1.5, Sever 2.0, and then he included the Thorn Rift 2.2. The shooting machine consistently was shooting groups 2 to 3 inches at 70 yards. For those four broadheads, mechanicals, they shot the same size groups at 70 yards. Coming out
wow,
of that
2 to 3 inches.
Yeah, at 70 yards.
At 70 yards.
Yep.
That's awesome. Because so, I know the fixed blade test, the best was the Evolution Jackal, which yep. shot slightly over a 3-inch group. And then the Slick Trick and the Grim Reaper Micro between a 5 and a 5.5 and a 6-inch group.
Which at 70 yards that's, is still plenty to kill
oh,
stuff
dude,
with.
And that's a poke.
Yes.
70 yards.
Yes, it is.
Like you and I have got our stuff dialed into 80, but that's like for a second shot. But still, that's a big difference between the fixed and the mechanical.
I mean, well, and
2-inch.
We've talked about it before. Mechanicals are just inherently going to be more accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's the design, how they penetrate, how they open, all that's where my complaints come in.
Yes, and that's where a lot of these new, because that's why I quit shooting the expandables, because I had a situation many years ago. But now I'm kind of revisiting that because they have so many different opening mechanisms now. Like
right.
They've got ones that open up after they're inside the animal and still open on contacts. And then the ones I'm really interested in are the new hybrids. The
yeah,
new
those
hybrid world.
Sever 1.5 hybrids, they look pretty dang sweet. I will bring up one point of contention, and this is not from the study. This is from, he released a YouTube video after this. It's Yates in the Backcountry. That's his YouTube channel, free plug there. He gives his 2 cents, how he likes to hunt. He said he always carries a mechanical, one mechanical broadhead in his quiver that he knows shoots with his fixed blades. He was talking about elk hunting.
Oh, okay.
For a longer distance shot. Now, I get that just because, okay, the only shot you get after an 11-day hunt or whatever is a 73-yard cross canyon. Like, you want to be as accurate as possible. And the reality is that's going to be a mechanical broadhead. My point of contention with that, though, is if you're only using the mechanical for a long-range shot, at that point, you've lost so much kinetic energy. And again, who am I, Henry Evans, to argue with James Yates or pick at his how he does things? Because he's a much better hunter than I am. But that being said, I still just, in theory, it's like, why would you, when your arrow is at its like lowest kinetic energy point, why would you throw a mechanical that requires that kinetic energy to open? I get you want to be accurate, and maybe that's the thing, is like accuracy is king. I get that. So maybe that's his whole thinking, is like, okay, if I can, you know, hit a baseball at 70 yards with this thing, I don't care if I've lost kinetic energy. It just kind of struck me as weird when I was watching that video. I was like, well, yeah, but you got, I mean, I don't care what you're shooting, heavy arrow, whatever. At 75 yards or whatever, man, you've lost a lot of kinetic energy at that point.
Yeah, you really have. Yeah, that's true.
That's my one little thing about it. I was like, man, if I'm going to shoot a mechanical, I want it to be like 25 yards right there because I know that sucker's going through.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's my 2 cents on his comments.
And that makes sense. What you said makes sense. I mean, I guess depending on the broadhead, how it opens.
So it is a really cool study to dive into. Do not go anywhere. Final segment of Nevada Backcountry on this Sunday is coming up in a minute. Final segment of Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. We got like 10 minutes of airtime to fill here. We were just talking over the break, and both of us being archery nerds are diving into this test and going, oh, did you see this? Did you see this? I want to bring up real quick the vane thing. I was not familiar with the vane that performed the best. Flex Fletch 360s?
Yeah, so they've
Have you ever seen those?
I have. They've got them down at Hunting House.
Oh, they do.
Yeah, they do. They're sitting up on the wall right next to the tack veins.
Okay.
It looks like another vein.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's drag coefficient is what, 0.076 or something, which I think that's a good number. I don't know.
Yeah, the lower the better.
Well, yeah, lower the better. I have no idea. I mean, I have seen them. It's a good looking vein, and you might
apparently it performs super well.
Yeah, it does.
It was the winner.
My big thing with veins is I wish they would have tested how well do they hold up, because that's why, like, I've been really dedicated kind of to the Q2 veins.
Right.
The glue cup to attach them to the arrow is, I don't know what he did to it, but boy, when you put those things on an arrow, it's almost like a suction cup that you've added glue to.
Oh, so it's stuck on there.
That thing is on there, where in the past, other brands I've noticed have come off. They pop off, it gets too hot out or something, and they just kind of, they've come off. Even though they're great veins, I want it to stick on there. So that's always been one of my top reasons, is like, will it stay
it
on
durable?
My arrow? Yeah, yeah. How durable is it? Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I prep all my shafts and I prep the vein before I stick it on with the primer pen and everything.
Yeah.
I've had that's the reason I'm married to those. I think they're the boning heat veins.
Yes.
And I run a four fletch, but same thing. And I like with those shot out 3D targets, if I bury my arrow in there and the veins come out looking all crinkled and everything, they're still stuck to the shaft, and I can take them home, run a hair dryer on them.
They repair themselves.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, these are just what I'm using. I don't think he tested the heat veins. He tested some boning stuff. I didn't see the heat veins.
Yeah, I saw a few
on
boning on there, but I didn't see the heat veins.
No,
so
that's what I use. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'll check out the flex fletch things.
Yeah, the vein I used was like just above the middle of the pack.
Okay.
Of all the veins they tested. And they tested, my God.
Everything.
That was a heck of a list. But yeah, everything but heats.
Yeah.
No, that was a really cool test. It was a really good read, especially if you're a archery nerd.
Absolutely. Like I said, James, if you just Google James Yates archery test, Western Hunter, the article will come up and you guys can pore over it. Following on the archery subject, gosh, I had a couple things on my notepad here, Dave. Looking at the clock, I think we can get to all of them. You asked me over the break for my hunt, are you taking a target out there?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I do not go on a bow hunt unless I take a target, even if it's just a cheap bag target that I shoot some field points or something. Like, I take a target with me always.
Yeah. Tell us why you take it out there.
Oh my God. I've had stuff rattle loose.
Yeah.
In fact, my dad had a horrible shot on a bull one year. Thank God he missed. And then get to realize, like, that bow went off and it sounded like somebody with a soda can full of nickels. And it turns out like something had rattled loose.
Yeah.
So
during
I always
the drive or the flight or anything. Yep.
Yep. I always do that to make sure, okay, what was going on in my backyard is still going on out here, and there's no new weird noises after a 6-hour drive, an hour of which is on a dirt road.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure it's that last little bit of confidence. And this year I actually picked up one of those little 365 archery, the yellow insert things.
Yeah.
I picked up their small one. I can throw it in the bed of my truck. It's perfect, and I can shoot broadheads into it.
Yeah, yeah, I've got that Morel dice.
Yep,
yeah,
I've seen those.
Yeah, I've got a few of those. But yeah, I always bring a target because same reason.
Yeah.
And then I shoot at 20, 40, and 60 just to confirm because, man, like you said, things come loose. Once. And
I always check everything before I leave, but it never fails. Holy smokes, just going to that indoor league at Hunting House, there was one night where there was a rattle that was making me a head case.
Oh.
And it's like somehow between shooting at home and driving 12 minutes up the road to Hunting House and shooting there.
Yeah, that was your sight, wasn't it?
I think as it turns out, it was something on my sight that it just rattled loose.
Just rattled.
Every time I'd shoot, and I was like, what is that?
It doesn't take much. And what my little trick that I learned from a good buddy was once I get my bow completely dialed in, competition bow, 3D bow, hunting bow, I take the silver Sharpie.
Yeah.
And I mark everything that can move. So I'll put a line across the riser where my rest is level. You know, I kind of outline my rest. So if anything does come loose, I just line it back up to all my lines.
And you're good
and
to go.
And I should be as close as I possibly can.
Yeah.
You know, based on that, I'll
without having a press or a
draw
board
or anything.
I'll
mark where my peep is. I'll put a mark on the string where the center of my peep sits tied to the... When you're out in the field dragging through the brush or bouncing around with the thing sitting on your ATV or your UTV and that bow's bouncing around in its case or on one of those holders, it's inevitable.
Yeah.
I mean, something's going to get wiggly.
And like I said, even checking it at home and then hitting the road, I've still had it happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So that's why I bring a target. And then, because we're coming up here, it's antelope and cow elk starting next Friday or this coming Friday.
Yes.
Shoot through blinds.
Oh, yeah.
And I've never used one in Nevada. When I was stationed back east, I had a ground blind one time in North Carolina, and it was the latest, greatest at the time, and it had the shoot-through mesh. Will not change your point of impact. You know, every hunting celebrity was hawking this thing as this changes the game. I took a shot on a deer, which, stupid me, I should have done, you know, in the backyard. I should have shot through it first to realize... BS. My arrow, and thank God it was in like a tree about a foot above the deer's back, but I just trusted all the marketing and I was like, oh yeah, I can shoot through this mesh perfect with a fixed, but with a slick trick. No, I wound up about a foot high up a tree, kind of off to the right too.
Yeah, I don't trust the shoot through thing either. No.
Have you ever tried them?
I've shot through them at a tournament. They had the mesh and you had to shoot through the shoot through mesh at a.
But with a field point.
Yeah, that was a field point.
Yeah.
And, okay. But I never trusted it. So no matter what, if I was in a blind, that came down. Yeah. And I just relied on the. If you're steady enough in the blind and it's set up properly, you're almost invisible in that thing, you know, especially if you're wearing like a black shirt, black long sleeve shirt, and a black hoodie, I don't know, something to where you blend into the darkness. You know, you're not wearing a t-shirt or something bright, but even then, it's still, you're just kind of a shadow in there. Granted, our eyes are a lot different than...
Movement is what kills you.
Yeah.
My Sitka latest, greatest, whatever, that pattern doesn't do squat for me inside of a blind. For all of you with tags starting, good luck. Shoot straight. We'll see you in a couple weeks. Tom Gresham's Gun Talk is coming up next.